G'day, no worries, she'll be right. It's a bright, sunshiny day here in Takaka, New Zealand. This is Golden Day. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson coming at you from Mother Earth here on Saturday morning, the 8th of February 2020. This is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 310. I spent so much time and energy this week on my, not so much on the show itself, but on the blog and email that I just sent out for OTB number 309, space, are we there yet? And as I mentioned several times, whimsically and in total seriousness, this space is the one of, if not the biggest topics that you can ever possibly talk about. I'm not sure if which is bigger, space or the universe, because anyway, but that's all a bit rhetorical, as it were. But just this morning, I looked out and saw a beautiful clear morning and the sun just coming up, but then this mass of really strange looking cloud like stuff appeared in a very long band going sort of like from east to west over me, and it turned into these gray, it looked like clouds, and it started covering the sun, but really, really weird. And you could see the sharp, well-defined edge of this thing on either side, and it was clearly a wide band that had been dispersing for a long time. And over to the north were two more bands that were much narrower, but they were parallel. Then, after about an hour, a plane came cutting across at a completely diagonal trajectory, kind of like from north east to southwest, spraying another line of stuff. And then another one came at yet another angle. So this is all clearly stuff that's being sprayed out of these planes. And my unbeliever friends just keep asking, but Jeff, what is it? And who would do this and why? And I get sick of trying to tell people over and over again, people that just can't be bothered to do any research on their own, what this stuff is. And I use the metaphor of a hypodermic syringe is a technology for introducing substances into the vascular system of our body. But if you think of what that could be anything that can be created as a liquid solution, anything. So it could be a million different things. The same goes for these chemtrails or whatever you want to call them. Anything that can be aerosolized and pressurized and put into a tank and sprayed out of a nozzle could be in there. It could be anything from biologically active materials, chemicals, substances, viruses, fungi, spores, disease vectors. It could be ionizable metallic salts that make the atmosphere more conductive to electricity or electromagnetic transmissions. For example, the 5G Starlink satellites that they're getting ready to launch, several thousand of them. Maybe this is a big part of that, to increase the transmission capabilities of HARP and all the geomagnetic warfare technologies that whose effects we're seeing so clearly. It could also have radioactive substances, like the former CEO or an advisory consultant to Booz Allen and Hamilton talked about. It can contain radioactive substances that can be put there for any number of uses as biological weapons, as a way of getting rid of nuclear waste, in the same way that depleted uranium served the multiple function of getting rid of nuclear waste that was building up in places where they had to store it, disseminating it into the biosphere where it can be a biological weapon and wage nuclear war in the true sense. According to Dr. Ted Wyman, it's not the blowing up of atomic bombs, it's the dissemination of radiological substances throughout the biosphere. Nuclear war, that's been going on even in Australia, with those giant dust clouds coming from the west, pick up dust from Maralinga and Woomera and transport the radionuclides that have been laying there since the atomic test in the 1950s, all across the whole East Coast and out into the ocean, even over here to New Zealand. So right now in Australia, we've got a giant super cyclone coming in from the west, directly over the Exmouth Harold E. Holt giant sort of electromagnetic transmitter facility that's probably key, along with Jorn, in terms of all the weather modification that's been going on in Australia. Got this giant cyclone coming in, probably right now it's over land. Then for the past two or three days you've had unprecedented, massive monsoonal type rainfall down in Victoria and New South Wales, the areas exactly that just got burned up by completely anomalous, unprecedented fires, are now having amounts of rain equivalent to what falls on the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand or in Hawaii, or what they just had in Fiordland last week, over 500 millimeters in one 24-hour period. And not just, and then with more similar amounts the preceding and following days. Same with what's happening in New South Wales and Victoria right now. Unprecedented amounts of rain. So this is, you've got record unprecedented fires, followed shortly thereafter by record unprecedented rains. And the forestry thing, as if the fires created a situation with all the forests in Victoria and New South Wales as if it was by design to benefit the logging industry at the expense of all the beautiful animals there, my family of life, the kingdoms of the marsupials and the birds, the koalas, the lyrebirds, the glossy black cockatoos, the forest owls, everybody whose furs they've got burned up and all their habitat destroyed, and all their food sources destroyed, the eucalyptus trees and all the undergrowth, all the limbs where they lived and everything. And then now, first they were burned, they had to flee, their homes destroyed, now their food source is gone. And then now, they're talking about how waves of predators like cats and foxes are just going to sort of move in because they're much more highly mobile than the marsupials. They can just move in and start just ripping to shreds the remaining life forms that are left. And so it truly is a precursor, foreshadowing, an echo of what we call mass extinction events that we believe have happened in the Earth's history numerous times. Now, this is all quite abstract because none of us were there to see or experience it, but like with so much of scientific thought, it's built on the work of other people that we take as true or valid, and it's based on a lot of assumptions. For example, the whole Antarctica ice core thing. You're not actually measuring the temperature of 500 million years ago. You're deducing it from substances that are there in chemical ratios and isotopes and that kind of thing. And the same with all this about the ancient climates and all this stuff. It's very abstract, just like trying to take measurements or read information about the surface of Mars, for example. We can't actually go there, so it's all secondhand information. And by the way, just in terms of the quote-unquote extreme weather now, and see, media is central to all this stuff, because how do we possibly know what it's like in Antarctica? But they're telling us that right now it's 18 degrees centigrade, a record high for Antarctica. And so, but also you've got massive blizzard conditions on top of the two really high peaks on the Big Island of Hawaii. So that's really nothing out of the ordinary. Those peaks are over 4,000 meters, so snow any time of year is possible there. The temperature in Antarctica, well, you've got these sort of anomalous hot zones that we've had in the ocean, like one out here in the Tasman Sea a couple of years ago. One's hot spots appearing all around. Hot spot, it's all over Australia. Hot spots in Antarctica, anywhere. Well, what do you think microwaves do? The main thing we know them for is a microwave oven. It creates heat. That's their specialty. That's their tour de force. If anything with microwaves, it's going to generate heat in more than one way. So to heat up an area, is like that's like grade school stuff for the people with the geophysical weapons. And to simulate or give the impression of warming anywhere, and they just warm up a few places, and then by the time it gets on TV, it's become global. So that's how it all works in a nutshell. I could also easily be talking about bioacoustics, the constant presence of anthropogenic noise like the multiple lawnmowers and chainsaws I've already had to listen to this morning, a plane flying over that sounded like a chainsaw in the sky, This is just, you know, I'm actually recording this show during a brief, hopefully an hour-long interlude in all these noises. And in this last broadcast and my blog, I talked about what I consider to be one of the greatest and most heinous atrocities that humankind has ever yet even thought of foisting on our solar system and our fellow bodies. And it's when the space race becomes space rape. And this has to do with who I consider to be a legendary comet and asteroid astronomer, Duncan Steele, whose idea to disseminate genetically modified organisms on Mars and any other place in the solar system that is quote-unquote barren of life. It's beyond insane, but it's not just insane, it's diabolically evil up there with impregnating concentration camp inmates with gorilla semen and Cornelius Rhodes inflicting Puerto Rican patients with cancer and then bragging about it, getting appointed to be head of biological research for the Atomic Energy Commission, the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the plutonium experiments where they injected unsuspecting civilians with plutonium and other radionuclides at Oak Ridge, and all this different kind of, this is up there with that, if not even worse. And astronomer Carl Sagan specifically warned against even the accidental contamination of Mars or anywhere else, and went to great lengths to publish papers about the necessity of absolute sterilization of anything going to Mars. And here you go with Duncan Steele talking about randomly deploying genetically modified organisms there. And this is something that DARPA has been talking about, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And so, for all I know, Duncan Steele is working with DARPA and also Monsanto or other genetically modified organism institutions, like, for example, at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where Duncan Steele's fellow research scientists worked for 10 years as a computer scientist on high-resolution mapping of the Earth's surface. But also, Oak Ridge has one of the most advanced CRISPR gene editing and sequencing technology research centers in the whole world. So this is all poised. And then their connections with Rocket Lab, who's owned by Lockheed. These are people that could actually make the effort to put genetically modified organisms on Mars. And I'm trying to invoke the wrath of the gods to make sure this doesn't happen. But that's not the topic of this show. This show is called Geoengineering, Comets, and Global Trauma. So this kind of relates issues that I've talked about before in a unique way. Now, I'd really like to thank Duncan Steele for putting me in touch with William Napier. Bill Napier and his research associate, Victor Klub, are the two most leading comet researchers in the whole world. They're very legendary. They wrote a paper in 1981 or 82 called A Theory of Coherent Catastrophism, in which they were the first to put out the idea that one or more of the, what we call mass extinction events that have happened in the history of the Earth, were caused or initiated by impacts from comets or asteroids. And so what we call, when we use the word event, that makes it sound like something that's relatively brief. In a time, an event is something you can kind of see it, maybe you see it coming, you see its onset, you see its duration, and you see its finality. An event is a discrete moment or window of time, and it's what happens during this time in different kind of ways. But so to call these mass extinction processes events is probably wrong. They may be, in terms of the long-scale geological time that we've sort of constructed out of our minds, event may be okay, but in terms of our own day-to-day life, a mass extinction event is not something that happened in a day or a minute or an hour. The triggering event that caused it, the impact, might have happened in a few seconds, but the repercussions and what came after probably took years to even really get going before all the sort of domino, chain link, feedback coupled and looped processes started kicking in, like volcanism and all the gases and emissions and smoke being spewed into the sky that was poisoning the atmosphere and blocking out the sun, causing the temperatures to plummet and then animals to die because of lack of food and freezing to death and blah, blah, blah. And this probably went on for tens or hundreds of thousands, if not even millions of years after each of these so-called events. So we're not talking about an event in the sense of if a bug hits your windshield, that's an event. You know, if Donald Trump makes a speech, that's an event. But an asteroid impact or a comet impact on the Earth and everything that comes after that is really best described as a sequence of processes rather than an event. So Kluge and Napier have been the originators of this basic idea. Maybe not exclusively, but they published the most leading-edge peer-reviewed articles that are quite scientific and statistical and graphic about it. And I'd like to thank Bill Napier for sending me his most recent article, which is very, very, very interesting about comet fragments and our potential for crossing their path here on Earth. But they talk about a much bigger picture than the Alvarez team, who got the glory for the mass extinction thing because of their discovery of the iridium layer that was spewed up and deposited all around the Earth from this impact. But Kluge and Napier's work describes this whole process from a galactic level. Now, they're not talking about just one event. They're talking about the whole process by which the Earth and the solar system might experience or move through what they call cometary waves, periods during which cometary impacts or encountering fragments large enough to do damage are greatly increased due to the Earth's passage in the galaxy and the movement of different kind of bodies and objects and things like that. It's quite complex, but it's very interesting because this is the real universe that we live in, the true astronomical perspective on everything. So they are giving us the picture of the probability or possibility of encountering significant cometary fragments and debris. And a lot of it centers around Comet Encke, that's E-N-C-K-E, that I've talked about many, many, many times. I think I first learned about it from reading Victor Kluge and Bill Napier a few years ago. So this is the one that probably has either it itself as a supercomet or fragments from when it's gradually broken up have not only been involved in earlier extinction events at different levels, but continue to do so and could create that kind of situation at any moment. And that's sort of the key, the crux of this whole thing. But humans, since the dawn of civilization, we've been engineering the Earth first by digging precious things from the land in violation of the Hopi prophecy, and then carrying that on and on and on, creating a military-industrial civilization to where we've now become the world eaters and the tyrants of the Earth, the Homo sapien macrovirus. But Emmanuel Velikovsky, the Russian psychoanalyst who I have such great respect for, even though he's continually bashed and demonized by all the people who he would have inspired early in their lives, he said that the ancient rulers of, like, for example, Sumeria and Babylon, that their biggest goal, their highest aspiration was to emulate the gods, and the gods being the planets and cosmic forces in the heavens, the celestial forces like comets, thunder and lightning, maybe things they saw in the sky that we haven't seen, possibly electrical discharges going between celestial bodies. I mean, you know, freaky stuff. Giant plasma discharges in the sky, sort of like auroras crossed with lightning. I mean, who knows what it could have been? The Earth passing through the tail of a comet or a cloud of debris that gave electrical properties to the sky. I mean, science fiction is replete with all kinds of descriptions of stuff like this. So what we've been doing is gradually trying to unconsciously or even consciously emulate these gods who primarily were not gods of fertility and benign nurturing of life. They were the gods of destruction. These were the ones that we feared and worshipped because they were the ones that wrought havoc and brought humans to their knees many, many, many times, destroying, wreaking havoc over the whole planet. You know, and you've even got the biblical things that Velikovsky describes, like, you know, if you want to take this as a historical document, the parting of the Red Sea, the pillars of fire, the flood, the deluge that's common to so many different cultures, mythology and story, all this stuff, Velikovsky likens to being global disasters created by close encounters with celestial objects. So what we're trying to do is emulate this ourselves through the atomic bomb, now through geophysical warfare with electromagnetic microwave transmitters that can do weather modification, stimulate volcanic eruptions, generate earthquakes, even global mind manipulation through brainwave entrainment and debilitation of cognitive processes over entire hemispheres. These are what the creators of HARP essentially boasted about, and what the patents for from Bernard Eastman, a lot of it based directly on Nikola Tesla's technology, they talk about doing stuff like this. We've been living in this world for the past 20 or 30 years, and it's just amping up. It's like they've simultaneously got to a new level of up the learning curve to where they've got the technology and the know-how down, as well as the will, the master plan on how to use it, that Australia in recent months has been like the showground, the proving ground for the latest level of geophysical warfare to show, not only to show how it's done, but to drive the stake home through any opponents of the climate change ideology, to go like, oh look, climate change is causing all this extreme weather, and so we better, you know, you better do what we say about it to ameliorate this evil buggy. But also to, as implicit in this, just like when America had the atomic bomb, it's a big lever of coercion that you don't even need to mention, that if any faction that they want to deal with won't play the game exactly like they want, all they have to do is say like, well, you know, I hope that your country doesn't have a bout of severe weather, because that would be very unfortunate. So, I mean, who knows what kind of stuff goes on behind them.
He's mentioned closed doors with the New World Order,
executive committees, and all
the result, one of the results of these cometary impacts.
But this is very interesting.
This is real climate change, how it's happened
in a world
on different scales that might have caused, been involved with mass extinctions, or lesser ones, like the driest period about 12,000 years ago. There's abrupt climatic shifts this is all based on our assumptions about the accuracy of our models for understanding what happened here thousands of years ago, but that we don't have any direct memory of, or recordings or instrumentation or measurements or anything like that. It's all in our mind. But, you know, given that all this has a degree of veracity, that's what they believe to be true. But I like the expression global trauma, because that's what we're emulating, the forces of global trauma. We have become, as the only species that's doing damage to the Earth, we have become agents of global trauma. Just like the comets and asteroids have been. But, you know, what we're looking at in Australia is like a small-scale version of what the aftermath of this is going to be. So when I go back to Australia in just a few weeks, I'm really going to be looking at and possibly trying to talk with and interview people that are looking into what's going to happen now after these forests have been decimated, all the wildlife, many of them driven to the brink of extinction, animals that don't live anywhere else in the world. This is so horrific, and it just tears my heart every minute of every day. And this is ongoing, and that just because the fires are over doesn't mean that they're going to be okay, because now their habitat's gone, their food sources are gone, they're going to be wide open to predators, and also the indiscriminate and often illegal logging activities going on, putting in of mines, new construction. It's just like, I can't imagine any other form of war that could be being waged in Australia that's not going on. So we're with the, all the geoengineering, and see, like now, a new thing that it's just getting official recognition and funding. It's been going on for decades, but now, apparently, if you can believe the articles, I think it was the NOAA or some other organization in America has just given a grant of several million dollars to scientists at Harvard so that they can prepare to spray sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere. Now, chemtrails have been going on for decades already, but I don't know, I haven't heard that there's been that much sulfur dioxide in there. There's been a lot of aluminium, a lot of barium, strontium, things like that that are mainly ionizable metallic salts that conduct electricity. And then we've got the story of a lot of the chemtrails, at least in Australia, containing incendiary chemicals that make ignition and combustion a lot more intense and instantaneous. So like the hypodermic syringe, the chemtrails could be anything, any kind of substances. But we've got the situation in Australia where everything is now wide open, and the forces of life and regeneration are going to be trying to get a foothold on a small scale in the same way that they did after the giant cometary impacts of tens of millions of years ago. But the sulfur dioxide, now that's the primary poisonous gas that comes out of volcanic eruptions, and I've smelled it, I felt it burn my eyes at Volcanoes National Park. They actually close the park when the levels of it get too high because it's highly toxic. It's neurotoxic. Even at levels of 20 parts per million, that's where the damage gets very, very serious. 20 parts per million, that's not very much. And so this has also made me wonder, this is kind of a footnote, that when I went to Hawaii, a lot of the people there, and especially over in Kona, which is directly downwind of Volcanoes National Park, they all kind of have a similar sound to their voice that's almost like they've had a partial lobotomy. And I'm not really kidding. I'm not really kidding with this. So many people seem to have kind of a very slight kind of brain dysfunction there. And I was just wondering if it was because of chronic low-level exposure to the sulfur dioxide, because they've got the VOG, the volcanic smog, that's constantly coming out there. I mean, you're almost never going to have a day that's totally free of it, but sometimes it's quite heavy, but it's always there. But at 20 parts per million, you're probably going to always have at least that much there. So I think it's created long-term low-level brain damage in these people. But if you start reading up on what sulfur dioxide does, it's highly toxic. It's also one of the main pollutants that comes out of coal-fired power plants from the combustion of fossil fuels. It's one of the primary, most toxic ingredients in any air pollution of a city. So now, this is the stuff they want to spray out of planes for the overt reason of, because it's, as a particulate, it reflects the sunlight back into space so the Earth won't heat up. Now, does that make any sense to anybody? They're spraying one of the most toxic substances that exists in the geological world that's not radioactive into the atmosphere more than they already have been because of its albedo, its ability to reflect sunlight. So, it's just, with Duncan Steele wanting to put the genetically modified organisms on Mars, and Elon Musk and Rocket Lab launching all these thousands of 5G satellites, and the spraying of all these chemtrails and the geophysical warfare, and still, the global nuclear scenario, oh, has it mysteriously just vanished and gone away? No. It's still there more than ever. More and more of the almost 2,000 synthetic radionuclides being created all the time, leaking out from every reactor and storage pond at every facility, and in Fukushima going into the ocean, and at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. I mean, maybe they're, who knows, they've probably been working on organisms that they want to put on Mars, making them special ones that might be resistant to radioactivity, because isn't that why they're studying the descendants of the victims from Hiroshima? I'm pausing for this plane. Still going on. It'll probably go on for another 30 seconds. At least there's not that many, but Great Barrier Island has the most loud planes of any place I've ever spent any time. Anyway, we've got this plan to now start dumping the sulfur dioxide. But I think that it's probably going to have even more of the substances that makes the microwaves transmit better, because it has to do with creating an environment for the 5G satellites. And this all relates with the whole space fence thing that Alana Freeland talks about, as well as Duncan Steele is quite tied in with the military thing. There's an article he wrote about New Zealand's place in the whole space warfare thing. And it's got a lot of technical information in there that I need to go over and sort of come to understand a little bit better. But so, it's just a very interesting confluence of ideas when you look at human geoengineering or geophysical warfare, the technologies that we have to do that, how it's being used, the whole scenario of how cometary impacts are believed to have initiated the mass extinction events of the past that have been major, what Emanuel Wielichowski calls cataclysmic evolutionary changes in the whole history of life on Earth. Entire ecosystems, almost at planetary levels, completely annihilated over relatively brief time spans geologically, and therefore opening up niches for new species to come in. So this is all stuff that we weren't there, and we have to use our imaginations and fill in all these gaps. And so really, this kind of thing in science in general is really no different from science fiction. Just because people might write it up in more detail and then pass it around to other people so they can verify it doesn't give it any more necessarily higher level of credibility than good quality science fiction, because it's all products of our mind. You know, but you've got substances that you can measure, like platinum and nano diamonds and meteorite fragments, and you've got impact, you know, glass that's been melted at really high temperatures, and iridium and osmium and all this different kind of stuff. This is what the science does. It sort of bolsters up our imagination with tangible evidence. But really, isn't science more of, it's not about, what does it mean to prove something? Proving something is really a matter of who and how many people you can convince to believe your story. So if you convince the right people at the right level, then that's proof, or de facto proof. So, you know, when people go, like, they ask me for proof of the fires in Australia being geoengineered, or proof that the Christchurch earthquake in 2011 was man-made, or proof of any other thing like that, I go, well, look, can you show me any proof in any kind of medical journal, any kind of scientifically peer-reviewed research that proves that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer? And, you know, it's a serious question, because as much as we are sure that that's the case, A, it won't do it with everybody. Just like radiation doesn't necessarily affect all people in the same way. Some people might not be affected by it at all from the same dose that others might just die and get cancer instantly. So proof that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer, I don't think it exists. But if it does, I'd like to see it. And it's a very serious question, because it's a given that we assume that that's the case. So what does it mean to prove something? How can you prove that the wealthiest organizations and people in the world, in their own words, talk about how there's too many people and they want to get rid of them. And they also want to transform themselves into non-living replicant machine-like things like Ray Kurzweil. You know, they tell about it in their own words. And so when my friends question me about stuff like this, I go like, but look, take the time, do the research yourself. Don't believe me, because they'll ask me a question, and then when I tell them what they tell them what I think, they go like, oh, no, but how do you believe that? That couldn't possibly be true. That's wrong. And I just get really sick of it. People aren't willing to do the research themselves. They're addicted to having a sound bite. And if what I say they don't like, then they can listen to the TV. I've been reading in a book, rediscovering an author who's was quite important to me back in the 1980s. His name's William Irwin Thompson. And I don't know that much about him, except that he was originally at MIT. I'm not sure if he was a historian or a scientist, but he quit. He quit MIT, and then he set out and he wanted to create a learning center based on the ones that used to exist 100 years ago. And so he ended up calling it Lindisfarne, and he built it at this very remote, special little place called Crestone, Colorado, that's in the San Luis Valley, about a third of the way from Denver to Santa Fe, right at the base of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. And I went there, I hitchhiked there in the early 1980s, and met some people there, and they sort of knew Lindisfarne, and they knew William Irwin Thompson. They said he was really kind of an arrogant person who was really hard to deal with, and he was never there, but they had all these bigwig conferences and stuff. And so, but he wrote some interesting books, and sure, they're quite intellectual and academic. And the first three or four of his books I had and read. And one was called At the Edge of History. I believe the first one that I had is called Passages About Earth. And then he had another one called The American Replacement of Nature. Well, anyway, I just found a copy of Passages About Earth on my friend's bookshelf, so I started reading it. And it's very interesting because he touches on a lot of stuff about, like, he was watching an Apollo rocket lift off in the company of Carl Sagan, you know, and stuff like that. But then he's talking about how he met with the original founder of this thing called the Club of Rome back in the early 1970s. And this guy's name, who's an MIT computer scientist named Aurelio, and I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but it's P-E-C-C-E-I. Pecci. Aurelio Pecci. Pecci. Anyway, this guy, I've heard his name. And then he worked with this guy named Maurice Strong that wrote this book called Limits to Growth. But what they are, it's a very sort of technocratic elite organization. You could call it it was originally a think tank that who was taking it on themselves to cure the earth of the human problem. And so I think that there's a lot of underlying agendas that they had from day one that they never, when you read their stuff, it all sounds like techno gibberish that sounds good on paper, but if you translate it into real world, it's actually quite fascist. But this was really interesting because William Irwin Thompson was actually able to meet with this guy and talk with him, but he was quite skeptical of what this dude was saying. I need to go back and read this chapter again, but William Irwin Thompson was observing that this Aurelio dude was, what they were really talking about was the necessity of a world government. And then Aurelio said, of course not. That's not a good idea, because any organization like that would ultimately become tyrannical. So he had already sort of mapped that out, but then William Irwin Thompson observes how that the Club of Rome was just like the political candidate who opens his campaign for president by declaring that he'll never run for office. He's not going to stoop to the low level of getting involved in politics, but yet he's launching his campaign by saying that. So that's what the Club of Rome does. They say that they'll never get involved in politics or bureaucratic decision-making because they're just a scientific think tank providing solutions and modus operandi for how to go about solving the world of the human problem. But they wrote a book, Maurice Strong, in 1990, called The First Global Revolution. And I've seen that book in hard copy. And in it, they talk about foisting fake environmental or social crises on humanity. For example, global warming. They say this. They're going to foist fake crises, of which global warming is an example, in order to manipulate humanity into accepting their agenda for a one-world government. And that's what the climate change thing has been about all along, in their words. It originates from the Club of Rome, but he was primarily a computer scientist. Their computer simulations there at MIT, this was in the 1970s, were the first earliest attempts, possibly even related with DARPA and the military stuff at that time, to create global simulations of world processes. And who knows exactly what level they were going to, but they're trying to model the whole reality of the world ecologically, socially, environmentally, politically, economically, militarily, atmospherically, all this stuff. And so, but imagine how far that's come in 40 or 50 years. And these computer simulations is what makes all this stuff possible, like geophysical warfare and all the atmospheric modification and stuff like that. But I think that we've crossed the threshold in the past few years to where artificial intelligence, if you want to use that expression, is now not only controlling and operating all this stuff to the extent of there's automated port facilities, there's driverless vehicles, there's drone planes and ships and undersea autonomous vehicles. There's now driverless tractor-trailer trucks in America. I even jokingly speculated that China was going to send robot tourists to Australia to fill the tourist gap. It's a joke. But it's almost like it's got a mind of its own. And even Nick Begich agreed with me a few months ago in our talk that I don't think that we can pull the plug on it even if we wanted to. Why? Because the computer systems that not only control all the nuclear weapons, but all the surveillance and the command and control and everything at a level that's far too complex for humans. Any attempt to disrupt their function, like unplugging them or taking them offline, would be seen as a threat to national security, which is the main thing their primary programming is designed to ensure the continuity of. They're not going to allow themselves to be interfered with because it would be a violation of their direct programming imperative. In the same way that Colossus, the supercomputer in the Fordham Project, brilliant science fiction, had control over the nuclear weapons, and they realized people tried to disarm the nuclear warheads without him knowing, and he found out, so to show his absolute authority, he detonated two of the nuclear weapons in their silos, killing thousands of people instantly to show that obey me and live, disobey and die. That his programming, he was programmed to eliminate war. And he was going to do that by restraining man. So that's a very interesting and powerful piece of science fiction there. Another thing that's very interesting that relates is that astronomer Carl Sagan, even though I got to meet him once just for a few minutes at the launch of a multi-million dollar NASA project, part of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, to do a 10-year high-resolution micro-survey, and then it got canceled the next year. So then SETI became private. But Carl Sagan was a vanguard in many ways. He was originally a planetary scientist for Cornell, who was given his first job by astronomer Thomas Gold. He did a lot of stuff with, especially with planetary atmospheres, including the Earth. Then he did the Cosmos TV series, and was a very ardent spokesperson for astronomy and the cosmos, and also the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He's very interested in the dolphin research. He designed the plaque that was sent on the Pioneer spacecraft. And then he became a very ardent anti-nuclear activist and educator, and some people believe that he contracted the rare leukemia that killed him because of demonstrating at the Nevada test site at Ground Zero over 100 times. Well, he also, back in the 1980s, at the when the nuclear thing was rearing its head again under the Reagan administration in Chernobyl, and Reagan had funded the Strategic Defense Initiative and the Strategic Computing Initiative, known as Star Wars. Sagan and some other people, including a guy named Richard Turcow, who was called TTAPS, these series of research papers about what he called nuclear winter, about what would happen to the Earth's atmosphere in the aftermath of a major nuclear exchange, how many different kind of toxic chemicals would be spewed into the atmosphere, not just radiation, but chemical toxins from the burning of stuff like tires and building materials and factories and munitions and all this different kind of stuff, how this would all go up and smoke in the atmosphere, and how this would block out the light of the sun, probably and create what he called a nuclear winter, where people would be freezing to death in the dark underneath radioactive clouds where plants wouldn't grow, people had nothing to eat, and so this was a horrific scenario that was being described. And the Earth has experienced similar events that weren't from nuclear war, but were from widespread volcanic eruptions, like these giant things, they call them traps, but they're giant solidified lava flows. One of the biggest ones is in India, called the Deccan Traps, and there's one in Siberia, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of square miles of lava flows that are miles deep, huge amounts of lava that came out, and they're believed to have been triggered by comet or asteroid impacts. And so the impact of a comet or asteroid could be conceived of as being an event that then led to extended volcanism that might have gone on for thousands or millions of years, and the accompanying smoke and ash and blocking of the sun and the dropping in temperatures and the decimation of flora and fauna from that. And then while that was still going on, or then especially when it leveled out and relatively normal conditions returned again, everything had been sort of recalibrated or reset, and then whole new ecological niches were open for new life forms where the previously existing ones weren't there anymore. So what's happening in Australia right now, in New South Wales and Victoria, might be a microcosmic version of that kind of thing. But it's so horrific to think of that what's happening in Australia is directly due to the hand of man. It's not a natural disaster. And for people to understand that, and to understand the karma that we're heaping on ourselves, and to understand the admonition from Thomas Bunyakya, the Hopi elder, who I keep repeating this because it's so important, but we cannot prevent the day of purification happening. In fact, the quicker it comes, the quicker that military-industrial civilization is totally extinguished, the better survival probability for life and Mother Earth as a whole. But whatever Mother Earth has to do to get rid of us and that is going to be so profound, so severe, so intense that it's going to take out a lot of innocent life forms in the exact same way that the fires have just taken out so many of the life forms of Australia. So we, because of the spiritual dimensions of the teleological universe, the Hopis believe that this is going to happen because of us, but that anything good that we can do now to show that we do love and care about life and Mother Earth and to live on the true path of the Great Spirit will help to lessen the severity of the purification, meaning that it will spare the lives and the suffering of all these, our countless myriad families of life, like the koalas and the lyrebirds and the owls and the cockatoos and all the snails and the slugs and the butterflies and the leeches and the kookaburras and the everybody. The flowers and the trees and the soil microbes. So everything we do does matter. But the new dreaming is underway. and blossoming in full force. And I'm trying to blossom in full force in every possible way and to fight the good fight. And I'm really looking forward to going back to Australia very soon to go and visit my homeland and to try to do as much healing as possible. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off here for On the Break Radio, broadcast number 310, Geoengineering, Comets, and Global Trauma. Please live simply so that others may simply live.
Oh! Mm-hmm.